Welcome to the Eclipse Wealth Podcast. This is your guide to making sense of financial planning and wealth management. It's brought to you by Eclipse Private Office and is here to inform, inspire confidence, and spark ideas that help you take control of your financial future. In each episode, we'll explore the key concepts that drive long-term success. Everything from building a strong foundation to making those all-important decisions as your wealth grows. You'll hear from experienced professionals who live and breathe this work every day, and from private investors who'll share what they've learned on a path to financial freedom. Our first series is called The Client Journey. Each episode takes you through a different stage of the financial planning process, helping you see what's ahead and, more importantly, what's possible. So whether you're just getting started or well on your way, there's something here for you. Let's begin the journey.
Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of the Client Journey series. In episode 2, we had a theoretical discussion about the wonder of compound interest, how time and consistency can turn small savings into something big. Today, we're making that idea a reality. We're talking about the first practical steps to creating your own financial plan to achieve future wealth. How to set good money habits and thereby build the foundation for your own financial future. To help us unpack all that on this leg of the journey, I'm joined by two brilliant financial advisors. Ashley Cherry is the founding director of Neo Wealth, based in Cheadle near Manchester. She tells me she is passionate about helping clients live the lives they've worked hard for without fear or financial confusion. My second guest works at the intersection of finance and psychology as a money coach, based in Norwich. She is Kim Uzel, and one of her specialities is to help ambitious women who've built careers or who've just come into wealth, but who still feel their financial future is uncertain. My name is Max Weatherby, and together we're talking without fear or financial confusion to create successful savings habits. Welcome to you both. So, Ashley, last time we learned about compound interest, the idea that the earlier you start saving, then the more time our money has to grow. But for someone listening who is just starting out, what does that idea look like in practice for a younger person?
That's a great question. Thank you for inviting me on today's episode, Max. It's an absolute honour. I think for somebody starting out on a saving journey, the importance is definitely not around choosing an investment, but choosing a direction and really understanding what you're saving for. Because you can't build momentum without a destination. And I think certainly for younger people starting on the journey, people think financial planning and savings is about numbers. But for me, and certainly for what I've learned from the people that I look after, the clients that I help, it's massively about behaviours and really putting in the behaviours that will last a lifetime in trajectory in savings. Kim, I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so often we just don't make a start because we don't believe or we don't understand what the real benefit is going to be. And we're too busy, especially youngsters, living in the moment, too busy having fun, too busy going to university, too busy getting involved in our first career, too busy studying, too busy socializing. We're too busy to be thinking about our future. That's a long way in the distant future. That's for old people to be thinking about. It doesn't affect me. I'm not ready to settle down and have children and mortgages and pensions. Goodness gracious me, what are they? So in the same way, I'm not thinking about saving small amounts. I'm thinking about having fun. I'm thinking about all of the other things that are going on in my very busy life. So I think the first thing that we have to get across is the benefit of doing this, the tangible benefit, showing that there is real beauty in doing this, that it's going to give them something. It's literally going to pay dividends in the future, but they've got to make a start because catching up comes with a cost. And we all know that if we wait until we can afford to do something, or if we wait until the time is right, or if we wait until it's not raining, then it's always going to just kick the thing further down the line and we're never going to get around to doing it. So we need to show young people that the right time to start is now. Even if it's just a really tiny amount, it's getting into that habit, it's getting into that mindset, it's getting excited when you see that first bit of interest credited to your account. You can see daily interest in some accounts now. I mean, that gives you that excitement every single day to see, even if it's a penny or two, it's money coming in, it's money being added, it's my money that's growing. How can we make this tangible rather than something that's just in the dim and distant future and for old people?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's really interesting, actually, what you said on mindset, because so many young people, my kids, they all see it as restriction, savings as a restriction on the now. And actually, the mindset of shifting to looking after the future you, it's powerful, and living into what your future self is going to need and that provision. It is exciting. And it's definitely retraining how people see the whole lifespan and not the immediate years and the immediate now.
We used to make it fun. If you think back to the early days of the National Lottery, on a Saturday night, people would queue up for hours, buy their ticket, and then they would say to all of their friends and their family, what are you going to do when you win the millions? What are you going to do when you win the jackpot? And we would have these conversations about what car we were going to buy, how many bedrooms we were going to have in our new house, where we were going to travel to, who we were going to give our money to. We would make a game of it, but we would be talking about it, and we would be believing in some way that it was possible. And then we stopped all of that. We got out of the habit of dreaming, of thinking big, of looking to our future, of exploring the opportunities. And we started just focusing on, just got to do this, just got to get through to payday, just got to get to the end of the year. When Christmas is out of the way, once half term is done, maybe on Monday, maybe next week, maybe next year. And we took that long-term vision out of our conversations and started focusing very definitely on, just got to get through this. Which wasn't helped by the media talking about the squeezes and the cost of living crises and that kind of thing. They're very short-termist in the way that they're presented. What we know, though, is that there's a future for all of us. And that future needs to be paid for. That future needs to be enjoyed. That future needs planning now. And we can make that conversation enjoyable. We can make it fun. We can make it something that we talk about over dinner or on a Saturday night with our friends in the pub. It doesn't need to be technical, it doesn't need to be difficult, but we just need to make it accessible. And that's a really big start for me. Make it fun.
What I'm hearing here is it's not actually about money. It's about actually talking about outcomes, whether long-term outcomes, desired outcomes, or short-term outcomes. And I suppose getting clients excited about that possibility and then presenting them with some kind of plan to see how it can happen. Because I guess the thing about the National Lottery is the odds of winning are very small. But I think we all know that actually, if you start saving, then the odds of winning, if I can use that word, over the longer term are actually pretty high. In terms of that, is it really that simple in terms of just you're a money coach, Kim? So I guess you are doing goal setting and things like that anyway. But is that something that you also doing, Ashley, with clients in that way, albeit with a savings objective?
Absolutely. And I think there's two sides to this coin. You've got every client loves instant gratification. And it's the click society that we live in. You go online, you can have it now and pay for it over 3 months and everything's on finance. Certainly the older clients that I look after, they come from a generation of savers. They understand the importance of and how many pennies are in a pound. So there's less of an education there with people who I work with that are currently employed, both female, male, young and old people approaching retirement. It's, as Kim was saying, getting them excited, but really working through in a visual way. What does my life look like on a timeline? What does affordability look like? What is the cost of living? What does compound interest look like? And just showing them a landscape. Because I think so many people just have a jigsaw piece and they don't see the full picture. So it's creating a picture and daring to dream.
Yeah.
That's really important. I think in the world that we live in, where everything is so accessible, and even just going down to my children, I remember, and I'm sure both of you will, going to the shop and getting a 10p mix and yeah. You had your 10p and you counted it out and you understood what that felt like in terms of the cost of it. So retraining people that money isn't electronic and it isn't just tapping your phone and helping people dream beyond today. And with today seeming so bleak with the cost of living and the various government changes. So it's definitely a behaviour shift and not necessarily just in the numbers.
You say a goal is a dream with a date on it. And yeah, I think I like the way you put it that way. Kim, is there anything more that you work with in terms of coming from your background, in terms of some of the things that might be helpful for people listening?
One of the things that comes to mind for me is that it's not any one thing that we need to be aware of and to acknowledge here. There are lots of elements. Conversations in families need to change. We talk a lot about, or we hear a lot about, education in schools needs to change. But also we need to look at the environment that we've all been living in for the last 20 years almost, where we've seen such historically low interest rates. So Ashley, when you were saying that your older generation, they are a generation of savers, that was when you could still get a gilt that paid 13.5%. You could still get good interest rates in your instant access savings accounts or your 90-day savings account that made that money grow and meant that you got a tangible return and a real incentive to save. Because the availability of debt wasn't so great in those days, it also meant that you weren't spending money on your credit card, you weren't spending money on Klarna, you weren't overextending yourself on your mortgage. So you had the surplus to save. So that was one environment that sadly for many has been missing for many years. And we saw interest rates gradually come down, settled at around 5.5-6% for a while. And then when we got to the banking crisis, we started seeing them reduce further. Then, of course, when we hit the pandemic, they were negligible. So what was the incentive for anybody to save? Because you could have a significant amount of cash and be saving it and having not even enough for a long weekend away as your return. So there was no incentive for many years for a lot of people to become savers. There was no excitement. There was no return. And at the same time, the availability of debt became easier. Credit cards became much more accessible to ordinary people earning ordinary salaries. We saw Pay in 3, stuff coming in, PayPal credit, Klarna, that kind of arrangement easily accessible to people. So we've got an ease of spending that's thrust upon us, an ease of borrowing that's thrust upon us, and no temptation to put that money into a savings account. And so I think we have to acknowledge that not all of this is down to our habits and behaviors, but down to the environment that we have been living in and the change in those times where it's just very different. So if you're a parent who's had a lifetime of next to no interest rates, you've had cheap borrowing, you've had no temptation to save, you've been living in the moment because you can, what have you been teaching your children? Whether you realize it or not, that environment, that cultural situation that we've all been thrust into over the last couple of decades will follow through to what they know, what they learn, and what they then do themselves. So it's a real retraining. But in part, that has to come from external forces as well. As much as we all love the idea of lower interest rates or whatever, if we're homeowners paying a mortgage or trying to pay off our credit cards or get a car on finance, it doesn't encourage us to save.
You make some interesting points there, which I agree with. And it's certainly the case that back in the day that you referred to before, you could earn a decent return in excess of inflation without taking too much risk. In now, in order to get a decent return, you've got to take some risk. And I guess we'll come on to that in a second when we're done talking about savings. But I think just to, before we move on a little bit, I'm hearing the importance of creating a savings mindset in clients. And for anyone listening, that's really one of the benefits of getting some financial advice right from the start. But let's talk a bit more about savings, because I think that's where it all starts. And you know, in preparing this series, this client journey series, I did reach out to a group of young adults, that is my adult children and their friends, and some replied that they just can't save much at the moment. They're trying to save deposits or the rents are so high. Kim, I'll just leave with you because it picks up on some of the things that you picked up on too. But some of them are saying, is it really worthwhile putting aside small amounts, say £25 or £50 a month, or should they wait to save something more meaningful? Is it worth putting that sort of amount away?
They wait, they will probably never do it, because there will always be something that comes along and takes that money at the end of the month, at the end of the quarter, at the end of the weekend. So there will always be something else that takes that money from them, because life is there being lived. They're buying cars that having work done too. They're traveling with their friends. They're going on stag do's. There's lots and lots of things that they have the temptation to spend money on, which are far more exciting in their brains than putting it away for their future. So saving something is always going to be better than saving nothing. Even if it's only £5, £10, £15 a month, it gets you into that habit and that money can immediately start working for you. So then when you add the next £5, £10, £50, whatever it is, that money is also working for you. And before you know it, there is a reasonable amount that somehow switches from being a small amount to being meaningful, to being, oh, actually, that is, you know, the next stag do paid for. I don't have to put that on the credit card. So that's proved to me that saving a bit of money actually allows me to do something, maybe not in the long term, maybe it's just in the medium term, It shows the benefit. It proves the theory actually works. And it feels good when I can pay for it in cash. It feels good when I don't owe any money. So we can build those kind of conversations and feelings into it and then say, imagine that on a bigger scale. Imagine if you did that for longer, if you didn't take it out and pay for the stag do, if you left it to grow and kept adding to it. And if you think back to the olden days when we used to come home from work, I refer to my past in so many ways, and it wasn't all good. There were challenges. I remember my first mortgage at 16%. It wasn't always easy, but we used to come home from work, from a shopping trip with our parents or ourselves, and we would empty our pockets, empty our purse, put the loose change in the biscuit tin or the whiskey jar or the container of some sort that would then grow. The money that might be a few coppers, it might be a few 10 pence pieces, it might be a 50 pence piece. When we got pound coins, that was exciting. Occasionally, you might put a note in there, but the change would just go in there. And it was only loose change, just a few bob, just a few quid. And at some point, we would then empty the jar or the bottle on the floor or on the kitchen table. And there would be coins everywhere that we would get very excited about piling up into groups of 10 and bagging them up and taking them to the post office and changing them for a good amount of real money that we could then spend on holiday or then treat ourselves to something. And that showed the benefit of those small amounts of money, literally pence, adding up. And we lost a lot of that when technology took over. But we've got things like roundups and save the change in people's bank accounts that are just the new version of doing that. We can get this back quite easily, but we've just got to talk about it and make people aware. People don't know that they've got this amazing facility on their Monzo account or on their Lloyds account, but it's there and it's free to use. And it's just the new way of doing a tried and tested method of saving little and often.
In a previous episode, perhaps you heard it, episode one, one of our guests referred to what he called the 50-30-20 rule that he applied with some of his clients and things. I'm not sure there is a rule as such, but just to, perhaps to counter that, is there something else as a rule of thumb that you think is a better one or that you use, Ashley? For you, throw that one to your direction.
I can't wait to hear Kim's feedback on that. I'm a big fan of naming my goals, just as something, it's so small and so practical. But when you log onto your online banking and current account, my current account covers, for example, my bills. So my current account is called Billy, and Billy takes care of all the expenditure, and he's not a fun account, and it's the account I dread to look at. But I name, if I'm saving for something or if I'm speaking to clients, putting aside money makes it much more personal when you name the goal, you name the account. And I think for young people who are in the mindset of a small amount won't make any difference and why will I do it? Going back to the whole conversation around habit, £25 won't change your life today, but the habit will change your life in 10 years. And it's the self-discipline in any area of your life. If you are putting those things into practice, it can change so many things for you into the future. And I also think in terms of savings for me, along with having different accounts, having your short-term savings and understanding that protects you from debt. What is that debt? What are the likelihoods of emergency expenditure? And what does that look like on a really practical level? What could that look like? But then also having your long-term savings goals, and that's your freedom, your dreams. You need both, but you need them in separate accounts so that you can really see how they all work in tangent with each other, but definitely not keeping all the money together. But Kim, I'd love to hear your views on the 50-30-20 rule.
So the 50-30-20 rule, very simply, is a rule of thumb that says you take your net salary, your take-home pay, 50% of it should go on your essentials, your rent, your bills, your essential outgoings. And sometimes the 20 and 30 get flipped, but 20%, for example, into savings and 30% then into discretionary spend. Spend it on whatever you like or the other way around. The issue that I have with this is that it's very much, you know, seen as a one-size-fits-all without the explanation that actually everybody has different needs. To live in London and to pay your rent from your take-home salary may take way more than 50% of your salary. I live in Norfolk. We get more for our money. We don't have such a big difference in our salaries now compared with years gone by where you would have had a bigger London waiting, for example. So that means that I could get a comparable property, but it only takes up 40% of my income, for example, whereas for the London person, it might be taking up 80% of their income. And the differences in traveling to work. I live in a rural community, so we need to have a car in order to go out to work, whereas somebody who can walk to work would have a very different need. But they come under the essential expenses. And very quickly, the numbers can be very skewed. Have you got two people contributing to the household bills and sharing those bills between you? Or are you paying for that yourself and taking all of the pressure and only getting a small discount on your council tax for the fact that you are a single person? That may again mean that your weightings are very different. So somebody may look at that, and a lot of people come to me, and this is a lot of the work that we do within workplaces, because they've tried things like this. They've been given that as a solution by so many people. If you put in simple budget tools on Google, that's one of the things that is going to be given to you immediately. But because a lot of people find that I'm not saving 20%, my outgoings are 80%, I've not saved anything. I must be a failure. See, I'm just no good with money. There's no point in me trying. And that belief in themselves is very quickly knocked, because there's not an explanation that goes with it that says, but actually, it doesn't matter what your numbers are. If your numbers are currently 85%, 14% and 1%, that's your starting point. Now let's see how we can change them. Now let's see what we can improve. Can we save 2% of your income instead of just 1%? Do we need to start with 1% because you're not currently saving anything? And where are we able to look at those essentials and maybe not make an immediate change, but maybe get ready for renewals or start shopping around? Or is there an alternative? Could you lift share? Could there be a different way of doing it? In order to make it much more growth orientated rather than feeling very restrictive and feeling like they're a failure. That's the biggest concern that I have with it, is that people come to me and say, I just can't do it. I can't do it. And when we tell ourselves we can't, then the last thing we're going to do is to believe that we can save a significant amount of money for a house deposit or our future, because we're just in that mode of I can't.
Okay.
The reason that most budgets fail is because they're trying to fit your life into somebody else's template. And I think the 50-30-20 template is so simplistic that it's perhaps a little bit oversimplistic, because it's not real life for a lot of people. And it's going to vary from location to location, from family makeup to family makeup. What can we do to just get that conversation open so that it works for everybody?
Well, thanks for that, Kim. This, we're obviously in the financial accumulation episode, so let's move things on a little bit. We've talked a little bit about sort of savings as such, and in that I'm reading that we're not taking risk or too much risk into some of the, perhaps we talked about some of the longer term goals and things, where obviously we are looking at vehicles that do take on some risk. Actually, perhaps obviously we're not giving advice on this podcast, but just to talk loosely in terms of what are some of the areas that you're using, and you can mention product names if you like, that you're using as vehicles for those longer term goals.
In terms of savings, I think that most people, or certainly most of the, call them products or ways to save, would be either an ISA or a pension, traditional ways of saving money. There's lots of different options outside of that, but in terms of short term and long term, the most popular are ISAs and pensions. And a bit of financial jargon for you, both are often referred to as wrappers that you can place money into. And when people often ask me, why do you call them wrappers? I said, you've got to think of them like a gift box. It's what you put inside that matters. As a really quick explanation, pensions are great for long-term savings. It's your long-term freedom pot. You can't touch it until later in life. So you're really paying dividends for your future self and for what you want that lifestyle to look like. You get tax relief on the payments that you put into there, and it grows in a tax-free environment. And then you've got ISAs, individual savings accounts, which are a great way to save. There's no tax on the growth, and you can take money out of them when you need it, outside of any fixed interest savings that you have. It is flexible. So it's a great way to save for the future and still have liquidity if you need to take funds out. They're the two main products that we use for people who are looking to save.
And I guess even in ISA, you can make regular monthly contributions, I assume, into most of those products from different providers.
Yeah, absolutely. There's lots of different variations of ISAs. But yes, you can make monthly, yearly contributions. There are ISA limits, depending on whether you're saving for a child, you're saving for an adult. There's lots of different options, depending on what your attitude to risk might be and how confident you are in having funds either invested or if you're looking for a fixed return. So there's options that can suit everybody and suit the majority of people's goals. As Kim said, and I think this is really important, no one shoe size fits all. Everybody requires something that's a little bit different. So it's really working out what's the goal, naming it, the habit of saving into it, and then what wrapper is going to be the right place to put those funds for the end results. But yeah, definitely they're the two wrappers that I would be using for saving.
And I guess that's where the financial advice comes into play, isn't it? When they come and see you and then you can assess their attitude to risk. There's so much going on in the press and on online about tech and crypto and all that out there. But actually, it's so important, isn't it, that people get that risk reward question resolved. Is that something you spend quite a bit of time with clients talking about?
We do. Certainly from a financial planning standpoint, it isn't about the numbers. It really is a journey into understanding the matrix of the person, the client that we're dealing with, everything that makes them tick, all of the information around not only future dreams, living expenses, their attitude to what risk they can take, their capacity for what they could potentially lose. So financial planning isn't just about choosing this is where we're going to stick your money for a return. It's a whole big picture. You've got to understand every corner of it for it to make sense. And in terms of definitely for me, for clients, it's about giving them a roadmap. I want them to be on the journey with me. So when you're working with somebody, financial planning for the future or for a specific goal, you want them to be as excited as you are about them achieving it. And so having that in place where they're really understanding why all these things are so important. And yes, you can ask ChatGPT and you can go on various chat sites and forums and it will spit out some of it, quite useful information. Actually having somebody that can hold your hand and really steer something that's very personal for you will make a massive difference. I definitely see the value in advice for somebody who is investing against somebody who might just be doing it themselves when they've taken out the advice of somebody that's been in the industry for a long time. Would you agree, Kim?
Yeah, so I don't advise anymore. I took myself out of the regulated space a few years back, but of course, I fully appreciate the value of good advice, having been in the advice space for 30 years prior to taking myself out of it. The people that I tend to work with now are people who, for some reason or another, and there are many reasons, don't feel that it's right for them or don't feel that they're ready to take the advice of a financial planner or a wealth manager. It might be that they haven't got a significant amount of money yet because they haven't started finding that direction. They are literally just setting up their first savings account. We know that the majority of people have less than £1,000 in savings. It might be that they've got a property portfolio that they've not needed a wealth manager or a financial planner because they've spent all of their time building up wealth in property, which is, of course, is a great asset class, but it's not giving them the liquidity that we want to see in a more traditional portfolio. So there are lots of reasons that people might not feel ready. They might believe that it's not right for them. They might believe that they're not rich enough, they're not wealthy enough, they're not big enough in some way to go and seek that advice. But they still need to learn, they still need to know, and they still need to get things in the right proportion, because what we don't want is for people who can least afford to take too much risk, putting all of their money into something that they've seen on Reddit or Twitter, and then being caught up in the excitement of it, and then losing everything. So it's almost even more important to get that handholding from the very, very beginning before they even get as far as having their first conversation with a financial planner or a wealth manager. Because if they can build their confidence, knowing that they've got that stability, they've got that bit of cash building, they've started adding to some ETFs or some very diversified funds, they've started taking an interest in something a little bit more specialist, whether it's specialist funds or direct equities, and they've got their eye on that little spicy bit of smaller companies, penny shares, cryptocurrency, whatever it is at the top. If we can get them to fully understand that from an early stage, building that pyramid so that you're not taking too much risk and you're building your gap. So if you've got a big property portfolio, but you're light on cash, there's a big gap there that needs to be filled. Or if you've got masses of cash, but nothing's growing and keeping up with inflation, then, you know, again, you've got a gap that needs to be filled. And they're the conversations that I think we need to have more of generally, so that people then can build that confidence to go to a financial planner, to go to a wealth manager for that tax advice, for that specialist help, for that accessibility to all of those products. But a lot of people just aren't getting there because they're not getting that hand-holding at an earlier age. They are taking that advice from the influencers. And that's not explaining the realities of sustainable wealth building. And if they don't have sustainable wealth building, they're not going to have sustainable wealth that they can then go and seek support with further down the line. We need to be doing this at every single level. Again, puts the importance on making a start in the right way, getting into those habits, and don't wait until you've got X amount before you go and have that conversation. Just find the right person to have that conversation with now.
Ashley, you mentioned pensions a moment ago, and certainly stakeholder pensions was one of the topics that came up from our young adults feeding back. And some of them seem to be starting new jobs with new employers and being asked whether they should join the stakeholder pension scheme. I figured you've got something to say about that.
I think if you're in employment and you are offered the opportunity and should be offered the opportunity to be within a workplace pension scheme, you should always join. It's an incredible way of setting money aside that doesn't ever go into your pocket in the sense of lands in your current account. So you don't experience the loss. It's going straight into a savings pot for you with the added bonus of the government incentive of tax relief, which is given in a top up. So it adds extra to the money that you're setting aside, and compound over the years of savings without being able to touch it will make a real difference to the income that you're likely to draw down and live off and the plans that you can make in the future. So my advice would be to anybody, if they have the opportunity, they are in work, or even if they're starting their own business, that a pension should be one of the number one things that they're practically putting into place to save for the future.
That's really good. And since we are talking about investing now, we're getting onto that topic, which is great. At some point in every episode like this, I have to remind listeners that the value of investments can fall as well as rise, and hence the importance of having some short-term cash reserves, as we mentioned earlier. And we had some feedback to the last episode, and I was asked why I had selected compounding rate of 7% in my example. The answer is because that has been the long-term growth rate of UK equities over 40 years. And at 7%, you will double your money over 10 years. In fact, the S&P 500 index has achieved 10% over the same period. And obviously, there have been periods, there have been years when investors have lost money in equities. So there you go. But this is an opportunity perhaps to ask you both about that. Are you looking at putting these longer term savings into equities in the main for clients who are saving for the longer term?
For me, it's a bit of a no-brainer. Provided the affordability is there, the capacity is there, you can now invest on the apps, on the platforms. You can invest literally from £1 a month. So there really is absolutely no excuse for the majority of people not to dip their toe in the water and start learning and start getting their confidence. What we need to make sure is that they are learning along the way, that they're not overcommitting, that they're not putting money in one minute and then taking it out the next. We need to teach along the way that this is for the long term, that volatility will happen, that there are good years and bad years over time, provided you've got a well-diversified portfolio, provided you've got the affordability, provided you've got the capacity for the risk, then this is likely to be a good move for you over that longer term. And we can look back at the data. I know we have to do the whole past performance is no guide to future performance thing. But when you've been in this industry as long as we have, you can look back and we know we've experienced lots of dips, lots of crashes, lots of wobbles, lots of recessions, lots of changes in government, lots of economic cycles. And throughout each of those, what comes is a recovery. And with that recovery comes additional growth. And if the general line of that growth is in the right direction, then, you know, happy days, we should be sticking with it. Because if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Don't try and look for alternatives when you've got evidence there to show that there is a real potential for you to build wealth, to make sustainable changes to your future in a really positive way. And interestingly, the S&P figures, we know that they're great because they have all the technology in there that's been a real boom area. But if you had put $10,000 into the S&P when it first started in the late 80s, that would be worth $4.9 million today. If you just left it in there and let it do its thing and compound and take all the growth, the ups and downs, the blips, the wobbles, the changes of president on it, all of those things, you would still be significantly in pocket. So whilst we'd all love to say the same is going to happen in the future, and we absolutely can't, it does show that sometimes what you've just got to do is be in it. As going back to the national lottery thing, you've got to be in it to win it. And even small amounts they will grow over time, provided you are sensible, provided you can afford it, and provided that you've got the right attitude to it all. I really do believe that more people should be looking at doing something with their money rather than just putting it to savings, which historically has proved to not be able to keep up with the cost of living and therefore been eroded over time. So what is the alternative? Investing.
I think from our side of things with equities, of course, I love investing in equities, but really understanding what the client's attitude to risk is and working within the parameters that they feel is affordable and comfortable for them in terms of their understanding and experience of the market. And that attitude to risk might change. I see a lot of my clients, especially with how the markets have been so volatile over the past 5 years, where they've de-risked. They've wanted the comfort of fixed interest when the interest rates were higher. But equally, clients who experience a decent return on a year and think, I'm actually now prepared to take a little bit more. So I think as long as it's from a financial planning standpoint, is within the parameters that we can work within and having it well diversified, there isn't any excuse for us not to achieve a return with a long-term horizon for anybody's attitude to risk, whether that's 20% equity or 100%. There will always be a return there if the horizon is long enough.
I think at the moment, at this stage of the client journey, I'm envisaging that our listeners at this stage are in their 30s and perhaps 40, that sort of age group. We're going to come on to the older age group later on in the series. Well, the other feedback that I've had also from those sort of 30-year-olds, if you like, is that they also feel strongly about giving back to their community, to charity, or supporting a cause that's dear to their hearts. I mean, providing for the future is in our human DNA, if you like, and ancient texts such as the Bible mention tithing one's earnings. But when you're starting out, how do you balance being generous with still saving for your own goals? Kim, do you have some thoughts on that?
I think there is so much that's available in terms of investment products, investment opportunities that can align with your values. It doesn't need to be an either or anymore. I think if you look back a few years when we only had a couple of ethical funds and those ethical funds didn't produce a great return. So in order to be ethical in your investment, you often had to sacrifice return. And that's hard for people to navigate sometimes. We've seen a lot of change in the way individual organizations and funds and whole sectors are moving in terms of impact, in terms of, I don't like just to look at ESG because I think that's a bit of a box ticking exercise, but in terms of impact, in terms of values, you can find something that really does align with your beliefs, whether you want to invest in a fund that only has women on the board, whether you want to invest in a particular economy, somewhere where you've visited and you really want to be able to help the people in those communities, but through building of businesses, for example, in that local area, you can still invest in it and get a return, but you're also doing something that you can be passionate about that sits well with your own values. And I think there's so much of that available now. It actually makes the investment journey even more exciting for a lot of people because you don't have to just stick with the FTSE 100 or these particular funds that are producing a dividend yield of 3.5%. You can get that yield, you can get that growth with the feel-good factor as well in so many ways. And that's a really beautiful thing because it will encourage more young people to invest for their future, to build wealth so that they can end up with a bigger pot of money to do more with for more people for longer. And that's my way of seeing it, is give it away once, give it away now, and it's gone. You can't build with it. Build it in a way that feels good for you and is there if you need it, because you may need it. But if you don't need it, then it's growing so you can help even more people, even more causes, even more things that are important to you for longer.
Yeah, it definitely comes with the saying, you can't pour from an empty cup. And I think if it's in your heart and generosity is at the core of how you want to set money aside, that's a beautiful thing. It's amazing hearing people that have a heart for charities, tithing, children and various things. It should be a part of your plan, but definitely not in competition with it. And I think, Kim, what you were saying, you have to build first before you can give. It's really, really important.
And we can give time. You don't have to give money. There are lots of ways that we can give. We can volunteer. We can provide education. We can go and help at our children's schools with reading, help on the sports field. We can do lots and lots of things that help communities, that help the environment, that help the causes that we are really passionate about without it costing us money, because it shouldn't be all about the money. We know that the more money we have, the more money we can do. But if you haven't got money, if you haven't got surplus, you're right, we should be able to build something for our future. It doesn't mean that we have to give up giving. We just give in a different way.
Because that's true, isn't it? Because investing is not a selfish act. So often you hear that, or people think that you're investing or being selfish. It's just all about me. In point of fact, I see that very much as actually your capital, one's capital, whether it's £25 or 25,000, is being used in the right way. And if you wish to invest with impact, with something that you feel strongly about, then that strikes me being as love backed up by capital, to my mind anyway.
Yeah, win-win.
It's interesting, actually, that so many younger people have an interest and a heart in ethical investing and the options that are available, rather than just the traditional way of looking at investing money. I've definitely seen the change working with younger employees when they're asking about the availability of where the money can go. So it's exciting.
I think it is. I agree with you. That's what I have had as a parent. I've had that message fed back to me for quite a long time. Let's move things on a little bit into talking about the habit side of this episode. This episode is subtitled Creating Successful Habits. So, Kim, what habits do you encourage, particularly for your younger clients?
Main thing that I would encourage people to do is to pay attention to the way that they feel when money is concerned. So look at not just what they're spending, but when they're spending it and why. So am I spending when I'm tired? Am I spending when I'm bored? Am I trying to fill a void? Am I spending when I'm stressed? Am I spending more at the weekend? Am I spending more at lunchtime? And then asking yourself, why is that? So if I'm spending money at lunchtime, what's causing that? Is it because I didn't bring a packed lunch in and I'm getting caught up with the cost of a meal deal, and while I'm in the supermarket, I just pick up a few extra bits and all of a sudden I've spent £20? In which case, what we need to be looking at is, what do you need to do here? You just need to potentially bring in something from home, and then you won't feel the need to go out to the supermarket. On the other hand, if you're going to the supermarket at lunchtime because you need to escape your desk, and that seems to be the only place that you can go to, what else could you do to take the stress away during your lunch break? Could you go for a walk along the river path? Could you take a book in or put your headphones in and go and find a quiet space somewhere else? It's not just the amount of money that we need to pay attention to. We need to look at the behaviours around it. And so understanding your triggers is a key thing. The sooner we can get into that habit, the sooner we can stop it. Because then we can say, I'm not just improving my finances, but I'm improving my mental well-being. I'm improving my emotional well-being. If I'm going for a walk, I'm probably improving my physical well-being as well. And great side effect is that my finances are improving too. So that, for me, is the biggest habit tracker of all. How you're feeling, why you're doing things, not just what you're spending your money on.
Yeah, interesting. Actually, we know that good financial planning is not a one-off, but a way of life. So what else, any other sort of tips, if you like, that you like to encourage for your younger adult clients?
Moving away from the emotive reasons of understanding behaviours from a practical standpoint, I would say automate as much as you can. Take the emotional decision away from what you're doing and have direct debits, standing orders set up. Even if they're just small amounts, they're commitments. Commitments are habits, and habits are built over a long period of time. Naming your goals. When you feel like you've got a purpose, you're far less likely to spend what you're saving. And treat savings like brushing your teeth, something that you need to do daily, and it's small but essential. And I think lastly, really celebrate progress. Even if it's just £10, you've done that. You've achieved it. £10 will become £100 and so on and so forth. So just from a really practical standpoint, there are things that you can put into place that should cost you nothing but make a big difference in the long run.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I love the point you make about automation. I think that's really a wonderful thing to do. It takes the decision-making process away. The default position is to keep on making that investment, that saving. But I think you also mentioned earlier that actually, in terms of that gratification, with the apps and things, make it so much easier to see how that fund is building.
Absolutely. It works both ways, good and bad. There's so many great things, even just on current accounts. I use Barclays, and it tells me exactly how much I've spent on what and where. It's worrying sometimes, but it does also help when you can see really visually. And I think for a lot of people, a visual understanding of what they have is the biggest impact, rather than a statement with figures on, actually seeing widgets and avatars really helps.
I love the point you make about taking some exercise and things like that, because I think it's so true, isn't it, that having a positive mental attitude, getting your head clear, is so important for all of us, whatever age, whatever we're doing. It's really important.
We know that when we're stressed, we automatically want to feel better. And when we're stressed, that way of feeling better is often spending money, whether that's on spending money on a bottle of wine, whether that's spending money because you feel as though you deserve it, whether it's spending money because you've made it to payday. We use it as a pick-me-up, literally retail therapy. And so if we can improve our well-being in other ways and reduce that stress generally, then we will improve our financial habits and behaviours as a direct result. So it really is a holistic way of looking at your wealth. And they say that health is wealth, and it's absolutely true. The two are so closely linked, and we really would all benefit, I think, if we just paid attention to some of these ways, rather than just pushing harder and harder to work harder and harder to earn more and more, telling ourselves that's going to be the solution to all our financial woes, when actually it just causes more stress and the money gets spent on other things instead. And we still don't build wealth. So all you need to do is get up and do a bit of kitchen dancing, or go for a walk instead, or watch a comedy, or listen to something on Spotify. Then do that, because it could pay you so much more than you might ever realize.
Ashley, if one of our listeners is feeling inspired, and I hope they will feel inspired from what they've heard, but what's one thing that they could do right now as a first step towards a financial plan?
Don't wait, just start. One of the biggest things that I've always done in my life is put off starting something for the right time. And as a spoiler alert, there isn't a right time.
Yeah.
Just take the first step. It doesn't need to be a lot. It just needs to be a commitment, and it will make a big difference. So that's what I would say is my number one tip.
And I guess a first step could well be just picking up the phone and calling a firm like yours, like Neo Wealth, and making an appointment.
Absolutely.
Kim, I'm sure you've got something to contribute on this one. What's one thing that someone could do right now, but later today?
Always got something to contribute, Max. What I would say is play with it. Have fun with it. Sit down and write or dictate into your phone or whatever a letter to yourself dated 2 or 3 years in the future, so that you're actually writing a letter saying, I'm sitting here on this beach, or I've driven this car, and I'm experiencing these fab things, I'm tasting these amazing foods. And it's all down to the fact that we started that savings plan, we started that investment. I'm so glad that we did it. If you put yourself into the position that you want to be in 2 or 3 years' time, or 5 years, or 10 years, you can do it for any time frame really, but some point in the future, and actually start creating it, imagining it, play with it, taste those foods, research those holidays, really get excited about what your future could hold, because then you start to believe that you can do it. And then saving and investing towards it becomes so much easier, because there's motivation, there's momentum, and there's passion within it, instead of just saying, oh, I've just got to get through until Saturday, or I've just got to get through till payday, and maybe I'll think about it after that. Jump into the future. Let's quantum leap a little bit and have fun with it.
Yeah, because it's true, isn't it? Sometimes when one looks at what the goal is, and it can look quite daunting, just like climbing a mountain or a hill or something. But so often it's just about putting one foot in front of the other, isn't it? As basic as that, taking that first steps. We're coming to the end of our time, which is sad, but as we do, hindsight's a wonderful thing. And so may I ask you both, what is one money lesson that you wish you'd learned in your 20s? Ashley, shall I start with you?
Still in my 20s, Max. Don't know what you're talking about.
Of course.
What's one thing I wish I'd learned? Every pound has a purpose. Decide its job before you spend it, I'd say. I was definitely carefree in my 20s. So having that time again, I would definitely put a purpose to the money that I had.
That's great. We can all identify with that. Kim?
As somebody who spent her 20s very heavily in debt, I would say don't compare yourself with others, because I constantly try to be what I thought other people were, what I thought other people had. And of course, we none of us know what their circumstances are. And we need to just keep our heads, really. And I would say, be very cautious before spending money just because you think that it's needed in order to keep up with those around you.
Thank you for that. What I would contribute is really is pay yourself first. And we've been talking a little bit about that in this episode. So obviously, if you're starting a small business, then obviously that's really important. But paying yourself first means starting that savings plan, whether it's £25, £50 a month. And as Ashley wisely said, to get onto that stakeholder pension scheme and things. That's what a lesson that I learned perhaps later than I would have liked. But here we are, we're in this leg of the journey, the financial accumulation leg. And the truth is, we spend most of our working lives in financial accumulation mode. So my guess is that we shall probably return to some of these points in a future episode. But for now, I really want to thank our guests for their insights. Kim Uzel and also Ashley Cherry from Neo Wealth. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us today. And remember, you can find details of all our speakers on the show notes of each episode. And so until next time, goodbye.
If you enjoyed listening to this section of the Client Journey series, then why not subscribe and listen to past and future episodes? You can find out more on our website at www.eclipsewealth.co.uk/podcast. Eclipse Private Office is a trading style of Peregrine and Black Investment Management Limited, who are authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority here in the UK. Please remember that this podcast is for educational and information purposes only. We are not advising whether a certain investment is suitable or not. Don't forget that the value of investments can go down as well as up, and past performance of an investment is not a predictor of future returns. However, if you are interested in discussing any of the topics raised, then please contact Peregrine and Black via our website to arrange to speak with an independent financial advisor. Thanks again for listening, and be sure to join us next time for more conversation along the client journey.